This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time, and soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
So before you listen to this episode, just take a moment and think of the words that immediately come to mind when you think about your retirement. One of them that may not come up is the word stress. Yet retiring is one of the 10 most stressful major life transitions you'll experience. And it doesn't exactly jibe with the ads and commercials you'll see about retirement, or even perhaps your own dreams for retirement. But it's a reality that's important to solve for and learn how to manage. And our guest today has very practical solutions we can consider. My guest is Dr. Samantha Boardman. She's the author of the book Everyday Vitality, Turning Stress into Strength. Samantha Boardman is a clinical instructor in psychiatry and an attending psychiatrist at Weill Cornell Medical College. She received a BA from Harvard University, an MD from Weill Cornell Graduate School of Medical Sciences, and an MA in Applied Positive Psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. She is the founder of PositivePrescription.com, a website devoted to making tweaks and changes that are life-enhancing and resilience-building by combining conventional medicine and psychiatry with positive psychology. She's been featured on Today, is a regular contributor to HuffPost and Psychology Today, and has written for New York Magazine, Refinery 29, Goop, The Wall Street Journal, and Marie Claire. So, Dr. Boardman, our listeners just heard your bio and really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, after listening to your bio, I became curious about what led you to go back to school to study positive psychology and become a positive psychiatrist.
Sure. Well, in medical school, I studied, everything that could go wrong in the body. And then in psychiatry residency, I spent 4 years studying anything that could go wrong in the mind. And I was pretty good at, I'd say, misery. I knew how to diagnose an illness. I knew how to treat it. I knew how to bring people back to their baseline and make them feel less miserable. And I'd been out in practice for a couple of years and seeing different, patients with anxiety, with depression. And one day, a woman I'd been seeing for a couple of weeks, for about, 6 or 7 weeks, she was just having a lot of stress with her partner, with her kids. She was overwhelmed. And she came into my office for our regular Thursday appointment. And she said, "Dr. Boardman, all we ever do is talk about what's wrong with me. We never talk about anything else. And sometimes I'm even having a good day and I have to think about what can I do and what can I complain about in there? And you know what? I'm done." And I never saw her. And she was right. I had been so laser focused on what was going wrong with her. What were her complaints? What were the conflicts in her life? What we could dial down in some way, and really not focused on what kind of made life worth living for her and what she enjoyed doing. And it was this wake up call for me. And I ended up going back to school to study positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And I learned about optimism, resilience, post-traumatic growth, words I had never heard in my training. And it was essentially the opposite of what I'd learned at medical school. And I took sort of all of these lessons and tried to bring them back and to integrate them into my practice to help patients find wellness within illness, to find strength within stress. And that's sort of what I've devoted the past 10 years of my life to doing. And I found tremendous meaning in doing that myself.
So your book is titled Everyday Vitality. How do you define vitality?
Sure. Well, the concept of vitality is an interesting one. And again, it was also not a word that I had heard very much when I was in medical school. Maybe people would think of vitality and Richard Simmons dancing to the oldies or something. But it really refers to this psychological and physical sense of being alive and having energy. And I was meeting so many people who felt numb, dead, drained, and were interested in like sort of that sense of feeling alive. And so that subjective vitality refers to this state of feeling alive and alert and having energy available to the self. And it's really part of this eudaimonic aspect of well-being that Richard Ryan and Ed Deci had spoken about, and vital, and feeling vital and energetic. Energetic is part of what it means to feel fully functioning and psychologically well. And Andrew Solomon, the psychologist, had said that the opposite of depression isn't happiness, it's vitality. And that really resonated with me. And I started looking at, like, what are the ways that we can help people build vitality into their everyday lives? Because to me, it was such an important marker of everyday well-being. How is it available to us? And I do think it's available to us at any age.
So there's a lot of things that can get in the way of vitality. One of them that you write about is stress, and you describe two types of people, Teflon and Velcro. How does each one react to stress?
Sure. Well, I think, me included, I think many of us are those Velcro types. And when something happens to us, it sticks, is like almost like a piece of lint, right? Like you sort of have some irritation, some micro stressor that happens in the morning. You spill your coffee, you can't find your phone, your keys fell like under the seat of your car. Those little stresses and how they can really add up and they can accumulate and they can really dictate then what how you react next. And stress is so interesting because it's not really the stressor per se, it's your perception of the stress, right? You can be feeling pretty strong, and when you have these resources available to you, you slept well, you just had a like great conversation with your partner, your kids got off to school on time, whatever those things are, and you're actually in a pretty good mood. Probably that person cutting you off in traffic is going to irritate you a lot less than if you spilled coffee all over yourself and your dog went to the bathroom in the house. So it's interesting how, and this is the same with trauma too, all these are perceived traumas, perceived stress, and a lot of it has to do with the resources that you feel that are available to you. And when we are more Velcro, and I think some of us, maybe we're born this way, but we can also learn to be a little more Teflon. And when the stress doesn't have that stickiness and that quality of just kind of lingering and hovering over our heads, and by paying a little more bit more attention to what I call the three C's, when you are feeling like you're having meaningful connections with others and in every day, when you feel like you're contributing to something beyond yourself, and when you're feeling positively challenged, those are what create these buffer zones against what we see as everyday stress. And when I was doing this research, I was really interested in this idea that resilience is common. It's actually what most people's default is to the big bad things that happen in our lives, those major life events. And there's George Bonanno, who's at Columbia University, who's done a lot of research on this. And this idea that most of us, about two-thirds of us, get back to our regular functioning. And some people even bounce forward, you could say. They experience post-traumatic growth. But most of us do return to our base level of functioning. But I think there's an assumption that actually people are constantly, that we're not resilient at all, that it's something that most of us will be traumatized. Even after 9/11, for instance, in New York, there was this assumption that we would have widespread depression and anxiety and PTSD. And actually, the reality was 6 months later, there was even money earmarked for that, and it wasn't necessary. So based on that, I feel that we have a lot of big R resilience. But what we don't have as much of is this little R resilience. And I think that's the resilience to the micro stressors, those everyday irritations that sort of get under our skin, those annoyances that accumulate that can stick to us like Velcro. And there's interesting research on this, that people who feel that who report a lot of just everyday stress in their lives, that it can impact their physical health and their psychological health 10 years later. So I even write about this in the book, sort of how you're going to react to a parking ticket today could predict how you're going to, could predict your health 10 years from now. So what were those, if you could fight these everyday hassles, what could you do to feel stronger within them? And how could you diminish and dial down those like micro stressors that all of us are experiencing? I kept meeting people who were feeling overwhelmed, stressed, tired, and bored were the three adjectives that people would use to describe themselves when they would come into my office. And so I was really interested in how they could create these buffer zones where they would feel that they actually had more uplifts to balance the hassles. And how could they be more deliberate about creating these uplifts that would create then, to get back to that stress question, that perception of feeling like there were resources available to them, and that perception that those stressors weren't as irritating because they had this buffering effect, because you need to counteract those hassles with uplifts. And there's a lot of things we can't control in our everyday lives. You know, if you look at those emotional equations, if you could say anxiety equals powerlessness times uncertainty, especially in the past 2.5 years, there's certainly been a lot of stuff we don't have power over and a lot of things we don't know, right? And this is a multiplication function, but there actually is a lot of things that you do have power over and that you do know, so you can write those down and try to at least figure out, okay, this is something, maybe I don't know if it's going to rain today, or I don't know when the next variant is coming, but like, I do know now how to keep my family safe and I can get vaccinated. And I know that if I'm fully vaccinated, I can feel pretty confident that I'm not going to require hospitalization. Whatever those things are, you have certain control, you have certain knowledge over things about. And I think when we're overwhelmed, which so many people are right now, and I think just feeling bombarded by those everyday hassles more than ever, that choosing what you can control, choosing what you do know, and being deliberate about it, and finding uplifts in your everyday life. Because when it feels like it's raining, it feels like it's pouring most of the time. But so we have to be even more deliberate in looking for those pockets of delight, something that is delighting you in some way. We know our brains are primed to focus on what's negative. Our attention, we throw it around like it's meaningless, when Twitter is consuming it, or breaking news and bad news is what gets our eyeballs and our attention. So we need to be so deliberate about those uplifts and those reservoirs of uplifts in our connections, in our contributions, and when we're feeling positively challenged.
So important. So what are some of your favorite uplifts?
Oh, sure. I learn uplifts too from many other people, but those uplifts, it is being outdoors. I think so many of us suffer from nature deficit disorder. And we know one of the most reliable ways to lift our moods is to be in nature somehow. And I live in Manhattan. I am lucky to live close to a park, to Central Park. So what's so interesting is I often don't feel like going in there. I'll wake up in the morning and feel like, ugh, I can't face it. I just, maybe I should go to the gym later, or I don't really feel like walking my dogs. I'm just going to walk them on the street. And how you almost have to override, people are always saying like, listen to yourself, follow your gut. I would disagree with that a lot of the time. Most of us actually, like when we are listening to ourselves, it's usually in that moment of when we're going to go for that sort of low effort actions, anything to minimize our input. And we're always trying to sort of do anything that's going to require less energy of us. But I'm always so grateful that I go. Every Friday morning, I have a friend who, especially in these winter days, I'd love to cancel, but she's waiting for me. And I know I don't want to be a flake and that I need to show up. So I think being outdoors is an incredible way to lift our spirits. We know it's this reliable uplift. People are less likely to ruminate, and rumination is truly an on-ramp to depression. And ruminating is when you're thinking about something over and over again that has happened, that is happening, or that will happen, and you're just sort of chewing your cud, like you are a ruminant, and you are going over that in your mind. Why did I say that? Why did I not say that? I can't believe, I said that. I should have done this differently. And when you're reliving this over and over again, and actually being in nature interrupts rumination. There are other strategies to interrupt rumination as well. We know sometimes people co-ruminate. Parents and children sometimes ruminate together. Grandparents can do it with their grandchildren sometimes. This idea of they'll tell me about something that happened to you. Oh, isn't that awful? Now tell your grandfather about that. Now tell your mom. Now tell your sibling about that. And it's all done in the name of showing that you care, but actually you're just asking somebody to relive that over and over again. And you're having one of those like ruminating conversations, even with a friend, when you feel like, haven't we had this conversation before? You know, and it sort of feels like Groundhog Day somehow. So instead of co-ruminating or ruminating yourself, there are several strategies that are available. This is from Ethan Cross's work, that are, first, go to a park, because that can help. But another way you could do this is self-distancing. And again, a big part of my book is about not sort of self-immersing. And I am a psychiatrist. I study emotions. Just immersing oneself in one's emotions doesn't give us perspective at all. And so one way to take yourself out of that self-immersion and that rumination is to think, what would I tell a friend who is going through this right now? What advice would I give them? This is King Solomon's paradox. You know, apparently he was a wonderful, you know, he had tremendous wisdom when it came to his kingdom, but not so much when it came to his personal life. How we all know this, that we are capable of having perspective about somebody else, but when it comes to us, we are, you know, woefully like blinded by what's going on. And so advise them to say, what would you tell a friend? Or think of somebody you admire. What would they do right now? How would they handle this? And I often advise my patients to even have like a sort of buffet table of people, exemplars, who they would think of. If anybody has grandchildren out there, there's an interesting study looking at kids who were playing games. Their temptation was to play games on a, like a fun game on an iPad, or to complete these kind of boring math problems, and asking them to think, what would Batman do right now? Or what would Dora the Explorer do right now? Then they were much more likely to persevere. So when you can lift yourself sort of out of those emotions that you're going through right now, you're honestly much more likely to tap into your own motivation and your own perspective to see something with clearer eyes. And you're also, the thing about rumination is it can be so like sort of paralyzing. We end up just spinning our wheels and thinking something over and over again. And big message in the book too is happiness isn't all in your head. It's really in the actions you take and the connections you make and how you participate. And the idea that when you actually take that action, you engage. And you know, especially when people are retiring, that you know, they say that there are several different categories that they could fall into. They could be continuers, that they sort of continue on. They could become adventurers. They might, you know, start a whole new project. It's act two, act three, act four. You know, when they say like, oh, I'm just beginning to learn something new, they take up different hobbies, they engage in something else. Or the two other type are being retreaters, you know, when they're sort of pulling away or being spectators and watching. And how can you know, one feel like one is sort of engaging? And there was some interesting research done in Chicago with AARP looking at a high school who had about, I think it was one college advisor for this like class of 600 kids of seniors applying out to college. And they were overwhelmed and they thought, well, maybe we could get some advice. There are a lot of, you know, people who were part of AARP who could maybe provide some help with doing mock interviews with college essays. Could that be helpful for these seniors in high school applying out? And indeed, it was a very, very helpful exercise. The senior high school students did well. They were much more likely to get into college with this kind of personalized advice and creating this relationship with the senior citizen. But it was also 80% of the senior citizens who helped these soon-to-be college students said that their life satisfaction improved along the way. Having the sense of purpose, their experience contributing to something else. I think having this intergenerational connection was so meaningful and purposeful. And really, I think that sort of captures this idea of being a continuer or adventurer even and doing something different that was so meaningful to them. And they all wanted to continue then with the program the following year. And so I think we sometimes underestimate the wisdom and impact. There's so much to learn, you know, and that especially having these high school students have this connection was really valuable.
So it's good to be a continuer, an adventurer, but not a ruminator.
Definitely not a ruminator, definitely. And if you know anybody ruminating, so now you've got some strategies just to intercept that rumination.
So there's an interesting term that jumped out to me in your book, emo diversity. What's emo diversity?
Sure. Well, I think we sometimes tend to think of our emotions or how are you today? You know, and you say like, I'm good, I'm bad, I'm annoyed, you know, whatever that is. And most of us will just say, fine. right? And I hope, I think my next book will be better than air quote fine. But this idea that you're one or the other, this binary bias, right, that we bring into how we think about our emotions. And ultimately, there's this tapestry of emotions that we're often feeling at all times if we're paying attention. And there's interesting research done on caregivers of HIV patients from the late 90s. And those who were able to describe these nuances of emotions that they were having over the course even of an hour of pain, of hardship, of having, of sadness, of, you know, anticipating grief versus having, and also at the same time noticing the, like the bird on the windowsill, moments of humor, like there were laughter, there was appreciation, there was gratitude too. So having this unbelievable sense of a range of emotions that one could appreciate and attending to them and giving them almost equal airtime in one's experience and honoring them in a way that I think we tend not to do. We tend to honor the extremes, you know, when we think of, you know, what's really annoyed us or what's really given us tremendous happiness, that those nuances that we're missing a lot of the time. And I think especially when we're lost in our phones, we don't have that ability to even sort of think more, can be sort of enraged and retweet something or like laugh about something. And look, I love a cat video as much as anybody that makes me laugh. But actually having the more, the appreciating the nuance of emotion that one can even have over the course of 5 minutes and not just focusing on what went wrong, what we didn't do, what was missing, but actually sort of saying like, wait, what's there? Actually, what was funny? Because you cannot find anything funny if you're not paying attention, right? I mean, there's nothing better than like shared laughter. And if you're looking at your phone, if you're not giving, even if you're watching a movie with a friend or family members, or you're enjoying a meal, every time you are distracted and looking at your phone, you're essentially unsharing a potentially sort of positive, like an uplift every time you're doing that. And so just the value of giving somebody else your full attention, of paying attention to whatever the two of you are doing at that moment. And, you know, look at your phone when you need to, when you're on your own. But even we know that even having a phone on a table dilutes the quality of the conversation that you're going to have. Interesting research looking at families who were out to dinner together. And they thought that maybe the younger people, the teenagers, would be a little less bored if they could look at their phones. And when maybe the conversation wasn't interesting to them, that they could like tune out and see what their friends were up to. But no, across ages, that having a phone on the table and accessing it, it undermined the quality of conversation. But the people involved enjoyed the meal less and the food tasted less good. So all of these little uplifts that we're diluting or missing when we are sort of half there and we're not giving somebody our full attention. So I think to be intentional about the time we certainly spend together, it's really valuable and a huge contributor to those uplifts that people report. You know, I was really good in, you know, the beginning of my career at Misery. But when you surveyed people who had a lot of stress in their lives, like what actually sort of helped them feel less stress? Number one was being in parks. And as I was saying to you, I find that to be an incredibly sort of uplifting experience. Spending time with a pet, spending time with friends and family, working on a hobby. It's interesting these days, I found when I meet people that the word hobby almost sounds so old-fashioned, right? It's sort of asking, do you collect stamps? And I was interviewing somebody recently and when I asked about what her hobbies were, and like sort of people work or they exercise or they look at their phones, you know? So like there's a, and this idea is incredibly, the value of having a hobby, and maybe we just need a new word for it. So if you have one, please share it with me, that some personal project, something you do that's truly for the love of the game, that you just do because it's intrinsically meaningful to you. It's not that it's going to become your side hustle and you're going to become cupcake baker, or something that you genuinely just love doing, and even something that you're mediocre at. And having something that's fun or joyful that maybe even you do with somebody else, that's just for the love of the game. And I think we need those experiences in our lives, and especially in retirement too, because they create, those are opportunities for flow. in our everyday lives. And we know that flow, that experience, when you're so immersed in an activity that you're not really thinking, and again, sort of to turn off our thinking brains, where your skills meet the challenge, where you feel like you there's growth and opportunity there. The classic examples is somebody, you know, playing an instrument or an athlete, somebody running a marathon. But flow is available to us in our everyday lives, but we can't find it when we're disrupted, you know, or interrupted. Certainly the pings and dings on our phones aren't flow contributors or enhancers, but where are those pockets of flow that we can find where we at least have 20 minutes, 40 minutes, where we're just doing something that is meaningful to us? I have patients who started gardening during the pandemic, you know, who started baking during the pandemic. But even you can find flow even if you're listening to a podcast, or you are making bed or doing the dishes or folding laundry. I mean, there's flow available to us in everyday ways, but I think we have to be in a headspace to allow for flow to occur.
Very helpful. So I noticed that sometimes people latch on to certain phrases, often jokingly, but I think these phrases can get in people's way more than they realize, and I'd love your opinion. One phrase I hear is, well, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I suspect you might have a different view.
Well, yes, absolutely. And I've had patients who come in and said that to me, you know, because people often come and see a psychiatrist at an inflection point in their lives, right? Like there's something change in some change that's either imposed upon them or self-imposed. But the moment though, and they tell their story, and that just how we tell our story is very interesting as well. And this old psychiatrist once said to me, who I have tremendous admiration for, and he said, what do you think the point of therapy is, Samantha? And I said, I don't know. You know, to change your future. He said, no. And I said, well, maybe to change your present. And he said, no, it's to change your past. Just to look at that story that we're telling about ourselves and how there can be so much nuance to it. But that gets back to your question of teaching the old dog new tricks is we get so stuck in this idea of who we are, of the story we tell about ourselves. I am a morning person. I don't watch football. I can't stand this. And often the time, it's really preferences that people have, or it's habits about who they are. And we're all, I'm butchering this quote, but we're all in the process of becoming. And I think it's Dan Ariely who had spoken about how we're all sort of in the process of becoming, and we can all look back and see how much we've changed, but we have such a hard time imagining how much we will change moving forward. And we're all in the process of becoming, no matter what age that we are, we're constantly changing. And so it's why I always push back on this idea of I need to find myself, because I think we're always morphing. And the moment you're saying that, this idea that you could sort of chisel away and when take enough time to do that, and this marble of this inner you will reveal itself, but actually that we are changing, and to honor that and to allow other people to change as well is so important. And so going back to the old dog, new tricks, it's just a question of sort of choices and being deliberate about it and seeing what we pay attention to. Ellen Langer, who is one of the, I think she was the first female tenured professor in psychology at Harvard. And she had said that sometimes couples after 40 years of marriage would come to her office and say, we're getting divorced. We're just so sick of each other. And one partner would say, he always just opens the newspaper and then he slams it on the table and he chews with his mouth open and then he does this and that. And just that, you know, that irritation that can build up over time. But she had noticed that nobody ever would come into her office and say, gee, I'm just so sick of my pet, or I'm so sick of my child, or I'm so sick of my plant even. And the reason is because you're expecting them, your pet, your plant, or your child to change. Whereas we have this assumption about our partners that we know them. We know what they're going to say. We know the end of the movie. We know how they're going to respond to something. And that's a conceit. And her advice was always, look for three things every day that's different about your partner. Notice something else. Notice how different they look in that shirt. Notice the way that they are, you know, maybe doing something different. Notice when they tell you something, maybe it's something they've never told you before, and prime yourself to be noticing nuance. For her, this is the essence of mindfulness. It's not meditating. It's just noticing what's different and what's new. You know, for instance, if you as people who are, you know, playing in an orchestra and they play the same thing every night, play it just a little bit differently. Not that anyone would notice, but just for you that there's more nuance in it. Somebody who's given the same lecture to a professor who's given the same lecture to a class the past 10 years, do it in a way that's like only you would notice it, you know, but it's just sort of maybe your arms are moving differently. Just it's imperceptible probably to anybody else, but it's more nuanced. Notice what's different. And I think also for us to be noticing what's different about others and sort of just retreating from our automatic thoughts, that autopilot, like you can't teach old dogs new tricks. Well, you really can. And we've seen this, and I'm not recommending that somebody go off and like, I'm going to try water skiing now or whatever, but maybe I am, you know, but just allowing for newness and novelty. And maybe is a shared experience doing it with somebody else, somebody you enjoy doing something with. We even know from people who are like, we're studying New Year's resolutions, people who commit to either like individual ones or ones that are deficit based, like I'm going to stop smoking or I'm going to go to the gym for an hour a day or whatever that thing is. It's a lot harder to do something that's deficit based, but it's much more fun and engaging to do something that's actually strength based. Like I enjoy art. I'm going to go to a gallery once a week and I'm going to go with a friend doing ones that are pro-social, that are, involve others. They're actually, people are much more likely to report a boost in their life satisfaction a year later, and they're much more likely to stick to it because it's fun. We're always looking for ways to sort of punish ourselves or to beat ourselves up and find things we don't like in ourselves. Do something that reflects your values and that's more enjoyable, and do it with somebody else. You're going to have a lot more fun with it.
Indeed. Great point. So the world's become much more specialized, and people coming into retirement often are coming from a specialized profession. And it changes how we see the world often. So there's some upsides to that. There are some downsides to that. Retirement gives you a really good chance to expand your horizons. And I'm curious, what's your point of view on what's the benefits of broadening versus narrowing?
Yeah, I mean, there's tremendous benefits that I think as we get older, that one of the reasons that we're sort of like fine wines and the research shows that we tend to get happier is because a lot of the sort of fluff, the things that don't matter to us as much, a lot of the negative emotions that people would report in their 30s people pay less attention to them as they get older. They sort of have whittled away what matters to them, what they care about, what's meaningful to them. Interestingly, I mean, I think there was a lot of concern at the beginning of the pandemic with lockdown that older people would have a harder time. I think one of the reasons that they didn't is because we're sort of, when you're in this contracting phase of life, it's different. You know what matters to you. You know what you enjoy doing. You know the types of books you like to read. You know what is meaningful to you. That it was easier in a way than being in your early 20s when you're in this expansive phase of life where you're trying to do everything, that your eyes are bigger than your stomach, you know, and the experiences you want to have and what you're trying to see everything and explore the world. I just think we need to be careful as we get older, though, in this contracting stage of our lives, that we just don't telescope, right? That it doesn't become too narrow and that we write everything off like, oh, well, that's just not me, or I won't try that, or I won't do that. To keep at least some openness to new experiences and to maintain curiosity about doing things differently and even about learning something new. And again, one of the things I think we don't think about enough is what a really good anxiety and stress reducer is learning something new. And in addition to learning something new, it's also teaching something to somebody else. If your life experience, I mean, there's tremendous benefit we all know in having a mentor, but I think all of those mentor-mentee relationships, I mean, it's really both who benefit tremendously from those interactions. And every mentor I know has always told me that they've learned as much from their mentee as that hopefully their mentee has learned from them. So I think, where can you add value would be a question, and what can you learn as well? And to keep that, just the window open a little to the possibility and learning something new, it's a great stress reducer. And if you have the time to be doing it, to just maybe doing something like a little bit different or doing something with a friend. We know how important it is to feel valued. That's a human need, a fundamental human need to feel loved. If we look at Ed Deasy and Richard Ryan's, like the three pillars of well-being, really it's to have a sense of autonomy, you know, that you have some say over what is happening in your life and the choices that you make, that you have a sense of competence, that you have some mastery if there's a challenge, that you could rise to it, and that you have confidence in your competence in your coping ability. The third part of that is that you feel a sense of relatedness, that you are loved and that you love. But it's so a huge part of that too, as we know how important it is to feel that you are valued by others, but also to experience adding value. Because to me, that's like really the core of having a sense of meaning and purpose, is that you've got both, that you feel valued, but that you're also adding value.
So when I read your book, I came away with many pages of notes and many questions that I need to narrow down for our conversation today. And I was wondering if you had time for three more quick ones. So the first one is about discomfort. So it's unrealistic to expect that we're going to be happy or positive all the time, retirement or otherwise. How does discomfort give us valuable data?
Sure. I mean, I might be a positive psychiatrist, but I'm a big fan of negative emotions. It's unbelievably important to learn from them. They are a data point in our lives. And I think we sort of live in a world right now that's pretty intolerant of negative emotions. We're supposed to be happy all the time. Anything that makes us unhappy or feel a little bit of stress is by definition bad. And I think we're losing the nuance in that conversation, especially even like around young people, that like this fear of stress, that there is these opportunities for growth and development in when we find like what we call desirable difficulty. It's why when we put effort into something, it's more meaningful to us. It's why people even, I talk in the book a little bit about how apparently when Betty Crocker came out with this cake mix in, I think, the early 50s, that this idea that you could just add water and make this delicious cake. And apparently the cake was delicious and it tasted great. And it was marketed at the time to housewives who had no interest. Apparently it was this flop when it hit the shelves, because people, these women who were the, you know, intended like customers of the cake, they weren't engaged at all in the process. Just adding water felt so empty to them. So when they created these focus groups of psychologists and very cleverly came up with this idea of, well, maybe they just need to add an egg. And this idea of like when you're participating and engaging, I mean, adding an egg, it's just sort of is a metaphor for connecting to something, putting an effort into something. And because effort-sparing experiences are rarely rewarding. And so having that desirable difficulty, having a little bit of stress, a little bit of friction. I mean, even I tell medical students today, like, this isn't going to be stress-free. This isn't going to be easy at times, but it will be meaningful and rewarding to you as you do this. And you obviously you have to take care of yourself in this, but this desirable difficulty, having a little bit of stress, a little bit of discomfort, and being able to also have a, when you are experiencing those negative emotions and you are, you know, people just say, I'm so stressed out, or I'm super overwhelmed, or everything sucks, or whatever that kind of language they use. There's research out there that shows that if we can be as granular and specific as possible about the emotions that we're feeling, that it can be very helpful in helping us almost put some police tape around that emotion. And so it doesn't feel as overwhelming and generalizable. It doesn't feel as personal. It doesn't feel as pervasive. It doesn't feel as permanent when we have the language to describe it as specifically as possible. And then also we have more agency and we're much more likely to act on it as well. So I think some discomfort is part of a normal and meaningful life. Some stress is, these negative emotions are, but how can we actually use them as data points to even help us re-goal at times? There's where we don't have the outcome, that things will not work out the way we hoped, but what can we do to learn from that? And what are the different goals that maybe we'll have to set for ourselves given the limitations of, you know, what we're faced with?
I didn't see a Betty Crocker reference coming. You surprised me. Now, so desirable difficulty makes sense. You also mentioned earlier challenge, and sometimes with retirement, people envision a life of leisure. But in reading your book, it sounds like challenge is a part of it too. How can people think about having the right amount of challenge added into their new life?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think, you know, we can use this in like a micro macro way. If somebody can have a stressful week and they just want to spend like the weekend in bed watching some TV show, or that people often will think about retirement as a way of like, then I can just be in that lazy boy with the remote control and everything, like the, you know, the rainbows and unicorns will all come and everything will be great. And really depriving ourselves of how revitalizing it is to have challenges and how devitalizing it is. It's a vampire of vitality to feel completely unchallenged. It can be lovely for an hour or even a day at times. But as you know, I mean, people after like a weekend they spend in bed, you know, watching Game of Thrones nonstop, is, you know, they're actually further depleted when they return to work on Mondays. And how we get this wrong all the time as humans. And I'm just fascinated by the disconnect is we think that spending the evening on the sofa or maybe even the rest of our lives in that lazy boy is going to feel good. And there's a study that came out last week looking at how people think that just, you know, if they have half an hour, an hour, that they think it's so much, it'll be replenishing to just like hang out and put their feet up. Whereas actually, they're going to get more energy. They're going to feel stronger. They're going to feel more alive when they just go for a brisk walk outside. You know, and I think this is just a metaphor too for kind of kicking your heels up and getting that lazy boy too, is what are these areas of positive challenge? Something you're already interested in, maybe that you never had time to work on, maybe something you already did, or maybe something that was part of your life, but not a centerpiece of your life, working on those strengths, something that you, you know, have a natural inclination towards, but maybe challenging yourself if you, even if it's with a language or working with your hands in some way, or maybe spending more time on that hobby in a challenging way, maybe taking a class if you're interested in that topic. Even there's so many cool classes to take even online right now, just where you feel like you're expanding yourself rather than contracting, because I think make sure that contracting is done in a deliberate way, that, you know, maybe you've figured out the people you want to spend your time with and how you, what's meaningful to you and what isn't. Robert Brooks, who we had spoken about, is such an interesting man. And I remember he's talked a lot about how when your values are reflected in your actions and how important that is. And one of the questions I ask my patients when I first meet them is, what are your top three values? And then I'll ask them, so how do you spend your time? What did you do on Saturday? And there's often a disconnect. There's a sort of vast gap between what they care about, what is meaningful to them, and what they actually do. And I spend a lot of time trying to create much more overlap in that intentionality. And I'd seen these questions that Robert Brooks had asked about, and this is a different way of framing that kind of value, how you value, are you walking your walk question, but it's saying, okay, what are maybe three words that your partner or your children or your best friend or your colleague would use to describe you? Then the next question is, so what do you do on an everyday basis to sort of invite this description of these words? And then, you know, three, how do you think your partner, colleague, child would actually describe you? What three words would they actually use? And four, what are you going to do to close that gap? You know, and I think, again, that point of thinking about what you value and then noticing, again, like, okay, what are the actions I'm taking to embody those values in my everyday life? And checking in every week to see, and even maybe with your partner, with a best friend, like, are you walking your walk? Because I think that that is an incredible, a very important contributor to that sense of satisfaction in your everyday life, is when it feels intentional and you don't feel like a tumbleweed sort of being blown around.
So one last question, if I could. If someone listening wants to have more everyday vitality, and I think we all should in their life, what initial steps should they take?
Number one, I think about those opportunities for everyday connections. Can you have a meaningful conversation with somebody? Sometimes I think that we just think talking about the weather is so much easier. Having meaningful connections, saying like we've actually had a meaningful exchange in some way. Pick up the phone, don't text. You know, if you want to do that, you know, if you ideally you could see somebody face to face. Then number two, think about a way that you could challenge yourself in some way. If it's just learning one new thing, if it's a crossword puzzle, if it's when the New York Times doing the puzzles there, if it's just one thing that you feel that you've expanded your brain in one direction, that you've got something interesting that reflects your interests that you've learned today. And number three, have you contributed to something? Is it in a small way? It's not going off and joining the Peace Corps, holding a door for somebody, checking on your neighbor, calling a friend you're a little bit worried about, just doing something for somebody else is a really reliable vitality booster and truly one of the best antidotes that we have for stress that we know. All of this stuff isn't happening internally. I think we've really interiorized well-being, and it's really in having an other orientation and having an outer orientation.
Well, thank you very much for this meaningful conversation, coming away with a lot of great ideas and new insights. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
So let's compare notes. What are you taking away from this conversation that you'll do and put into action? Here are four things on my list that I'll share with you. The first one is the three C's: meaningful conversations, contribution, and challenge. What are some new things that you're taking on, novel things you're trying, new things you're willing to learn? How can you bring more positive challenge into your day-to-day? That's number one on my list. Number two is attention. And I appreciate what Dr. Borbin said about giving someone the gift of your full attention in a world that now is full of just constant disruptions and distractions is a truly important gift. And that includes to ourselves. Are you giving your full attention to what you're doing, what you're focused on, what you're experiencing now? And I appreciate what you suggested about notice new things about your partner. What are three new things you can notice about your partner today? What's new? What's different? Very helpful. And then related to that, notice more of the nuance and notice more about your emotions. Develop a broader and richer vocabulary that'll help us label our emotions better and pay particular attention to what are our emotions signaling to us. Notice that you're ruminating. I love her suggestion of get out in nature, take a walk. Co-ruminating. Well, phrase comes to mind for me is take a hike. But more constructively, notice if you see co-ruminating, what choices do you have? What choices do you have with how where you're going to invest your attention? And how can you flip the script, redirect, suggest something new, and break that pattern if it's something you're experiencing in your life? I love her suggestion about a council of exemplars. What would so-and-so do? How would so-and-so handle it? What advice would you give a friend? Number three is my favorite, uplifts. What are some things you can do to get those uplifts and really transcend those day-to-day, everyday annoyances and stresses? Look for those, create those, as she said, uplifts every day. So that's high on my list. And then fourth and finally, story. What are the stories you're telling yourself? And what's going to be your new narrative for this next phase of life? And what actions are you taking? Or will you take to create it? Thanks for listening to the podcast. Our mission is to help you balance your planning for retirement by focusing on how you're going to invest your time. And through these conversations to help you translate insights into actions.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.